So let us get started. There is this thing that I sent on mail. I'm not quite sure. There's nothing much to discuss on this. The numbers tell their own story. So thanks for doing the survey. It gives me an idea as to how people are doing. It seems from my point of view, there isn't any major course correction that is needed. But as I said, if you see different interpretation of these numbers, you should let me know. And then furthermore, I guess it's useful from your point of view also, if in fact you thought it's going very slow and you found that most people think it's actually going very fast, then you know that you're in the minority and vice versa. Okay. So it's just, it gets us all into the same page to some extent. Any questions on this stuff? It's easy to see it. In case you could not see it on the blog, which cuts it off, if it's easy to see it from the mail archive. If you go to the mail archive and then you click on that, you get that thing again. Okay. And the other thing is Sudoku with CSP is going to be the project. If you open that, that's still not there because I'm going to put it by the end of the day today. But you do have the code. Let me actually kind of, since I have you guys here, let me sort of try to give you an idea as to how this code looks. You know, so it's like a, you're going to represent, again, you have to look at this slowly when you're sitting at home, but you know, I'm just giving you an idea of where, I'm going to give you a whole bunch of code, basically, which is going to do the backtracking, and you're just going to add variable and value ordering heuristics and forward checking, and then see how much they affect the performance, okay? So, basically the Sudoku board itself is represented as an array directly. Okay, so you use an array representation and then this is the top level backtracking call and it actually has you know, the board and these are a bunch of flags. Currently I just set them up there. MRV is most remaining values, LCV is most constrained variable and least constraining value. That's what it should be, okay? And then FC is, of course, forward checking. AC is arc consistency. I didn't discuss it as yet in the class. I'm not decided whether or not I'm going to use that flag and whether I'm going to ask you for arc consistency implementation. If I do ask you, then I would have discussed it by then, okay? However, these are all optional parameters. So these parameters, if you set them nil, then essentially it just doesn't do those things. Okay. Now, of course, to make sure that it does MRV when MRV is set to true, you actually add a bunch of code inside this. Okay, inside this shell. Now, the shell also has, you know, some. This project actually is somewhat shorter, not easier necessarily, but shorter than the other one. Because it's also another search thing, but we are doing it with CSP this time. So you set the assignment count and you keep track of the number of times you do assignments. Okay, this is all the code I'm giving you. So you don't, this is just to give you an idea what's going on. And then in the backtracking, basically you call a recursive backtracking procedure. Okay, now the recursive, the important thing that this backtracking procedure essentially is taking a board and picking a unassigned slot in the board. But those of you who don't know Sudoku, please read up, you know, something. I mean, I'll give you a link. You know, there are like 1.5 million links explaining Sudoku, the game. But I'll give you one that you can look at. Okay. So all we're going to do is you would start with one of the unassigned variables, consider the remaining values that it still has, and pick that variable and commit. When you commit, you increment the assignment count. Okay, and so in a way, by the end, if you have, you would know how many times you set a variable to a value. if you tried to set a variable to a value in a branch and you failed and backtracked, that those assignments keep accumulating. So you know how much extra search you did. You know, if in fact, if you're lucky, if I give you a board with only 10 blank values, that means only 10 places where there are no numbers right now, then you should just be done with 10 assignments if you're lucky, right? But anything else meant you did the assignment, you had to backtrack again. So the number of assignments is a good way of figuring out how much search you did. So that's the thing, that's the one that you use for the statistics, okay? So then notice that I have put here, if MRV is set, then you would have to actually change this piece of code such that it does the MRV, okay? And similarly, if LCV is set, then you have to change this piece of code, which is order domain values. Both of these currently just do the obvious thing, which is pick the first variable and pick the first value of the variable. But if those values are, if those flags are true, then you would they should actually see that and do the most constrained variable and least constraining values. Okay. And finally, then you, after that, you pick a variable and you commit to it. And then after committing, if the forward checking is set to be true, then you should actually write a piece of code here which does the forward checking. Okay. And then similarly, if the arc consistency is checked, selected, in fact, as I said, I may not ask you to do arc consistency, but if I set arc consistency, if I ask you to do it, you know, if I wind up explaining, then you wind up adding code for arc consistency there, okay? Then essentially this code, if it doesn't find a solution, which means there are no unassigned variables, you know, there are still unassigned variables and you have already violated the constraint, it just goes up, okay? And then it recursively backtracks. The interesting parts, of course, these are the pieces that you will wind up having to write. These are currently shells. They're just doing the first variable and the first value, okay? And you will wind up having to write it. One of the interesting things is this code will work for the small Sudoku puzzles already, okay? But if you don't add the variable heuristics, then it'll take forever for the larger ones. Now, of course, all puzzles are of the same size. It turns out that small versus large in Sudoku is not based on the number of, it's not based on the size of the puzzle. It's based on how critically constrained the board is. Okay. Now, this is actually the interesting part. You need to understand this in as much as you want to understand how exactly are the constraints implemented, okay? In this, when we discussed CSP, I left it open as to how constraints are implemented, okay? So you could implement them declaratively. You can say constraints essentially are the set of legal composite variables, composite assignments, or the set of illegal composite assignments, okay? Or you can actually write each constraint as a piece of code. Okay, it turns out all the CSP algorithms that we have looked at will work even if each constraint is another piece of code. And you just call all the constraints saying, are you happy, are you happy, are you happy? And if all the constraints are happy, then your assignments currently are not dead yet. If any constraint is unhappy, then the assignment is dead. Okay, so in fact, one of the things that you would wind up doing, this is actually winds up being a difference between SAT and CSP algorithms, SAT and CSP implementations. In SAT implementations, you wind up writing the constraints as clauses, which are explicitly written as clauses. In CSP, you more often than not, you tend to write the constraints as pieces of code, which actually makes it easier in some cases because, for example, if my constraint is X is greater than Y, okay, writing it as either the set, I mean, if X and Y are real variables or even integer variables between 1 and million, right? To say X is greater than Y, to represent this as a set of legal assignments or a set of illegal assignments is going to kill you because they'll be too large. Whereas if I just say X is greater than Y as a program, as a piece of code, all it has to say is yes, I'm happy, no, I'm not happy. And it turns out everything about CSP, the most constrained variable, most least constraining value, arc consistency, power checking, all of these can be implemented even if each constraint is a separate piece of code. Okay, so that's what we'll actually wind up doing here. So what this piece is doing is it takes the board and X and Y, which is the coordinates of one of the positions in the board, and it tries to essentially ask each constraint. So what it's trying to do is in the given board, it's trying to figure out what are the values that this position can still take. Let's say there is a position here. It's trying to figure out what are the values that this position can still take. This is currently unassigned. Okay. Notice that I'll assume that you know Sudoku. So this is going to be anywhere between 1 to 9. If it is 0, that is blank. 0 is considered as the blank. Okay. Now, originally when you come in, you will assume all 1 to 9 are feasible. That's what this piece of code is doing. It essentially made up a little array of size 9, and it said all values, each index of that array is a value, okay, 1, 2, etc. And it's basically setting all of them to true. That means all of them are feasible right now. And then you will ask each of the constraints, the column constraint, the row constraint, the block constraint, okay? Tell me which of the values are you not happy with. And anybody is unhappy with any of the values, you remove that value. Okay, so for example, in the beginning I think this can be anywhere between 1 to 9. But then suppose there is a 1 here and a 4 here and a 5 here in this column. Everything else is unassigned. I know this cannot be 1, cannot be 4, cannot be 5. So I make 1, 4 and 5 nil. The indices 1, 4 and 5 will become nil now. Okay, and similarly there is a row constraint. Suppose there is a 7 and 8, now 7 and 8 are gone too. And similarly there is a block constraint. In this block constraint, if there is a 1, 7, 9, then 7 and 9 and 1 are gone again. Now of course, a specific value might have been deleted by more than one constraint. All you care is what are the values that are still left after all constraints have looked at. So what you did, just a second. What you did here is you call each of the constraints who then modify, the way this is implemented is that they modify this array, which is the values, possible values, by saying, okay, you can't have this value, you can't have this value, you can't have this value. Okay, and then after all of them, you now go through this little loop here and see from 1 to 9 and see if any of the cells still are true. If so, that is the index of that cell is a value. You understand? There are like two different arrays that are going on. One is Sudoku array itself. The other, the way this piece of code is written, I'm just putting myself, an array 1 to 9. And these are basically just a list of possible values. Again, this stuff can be implemented in many different ways. I'm just giving you a piece of code that you can change, and I'm just explaining to you how that is, the current version is written. So anyway, you basically look to see, after all the constraints are over, then let's say this one says true here, nil, 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 true. That basically means only 1 and 9 are feasible. Everything else is infeasible. So when you come out of this loop here, you would say 1 and 9 are the values that are still feasible for X, Y. This is how you compute the possible values for each of the variables. Okay. So then, given this, all you need to do then to actually compute the constraints is this. I also gave you the pieces of constraints, actually. This is the column constraint. And, you do array arithmetic. In array, how are the columns going? And then just go through, take the column in which this cell is, okay? And then make sure and see if there is a value in that cell which is not 0. If it is 0, it's blank. If it is not 0, then that particular index winds up becoming nil in this array. It's a kind of a weird implementation, but it's one reasonable way to do it. Okay, so that's all this one is doing. Okay, and similarly for row constraints, when the digit is not 0 in that row, then that digit cannot be taken by X, Y anymore. So you go into that digit index and set nil in this. So you're just remembering, imagine this as remembering you know, one another way you could have done this is to actually keep a list of possible values and then process it. You know, beginning the list is 1 to 9, and then you keep processing them through each of the constraints, and then list becomes smaller and smaller, and if it ever becomes empty, you're dead. If not, whatever is the smallest list that you can keep. I just did it this way. Okay? Then, so this is row constraint, this is column constraint, and there is a block constraint, which of course is what I should have asked you to do. It is the harder one to write, but I wrote it for you still. Okay? Because it's not really particularly hard. It's just, you know, you have to figure out the indices for each of the sub-blocks based on XY. But it's cute to see, you know, how you can use the loop to do the block constraint too. Okay? And now the one thing that I might ask you is that there are versions of Sudoku which also have, this is the vanilla Sudoku, right, which has row, column, and block constraints. But there are versions of Sudoku which also enforce diagonal constraints. The great diagonal should have different numbers. Okay. I might ask you to do that, in which case you would have to write that constraint too, just to say that you understood how the constraints are written. Okay. Think of this as, if you consider this in conjunction, in comparison to first project. In first project, I gave you how to generate some of the children, and I asked you to write pieces of code for the rest of the children. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, now having done that, then so those are the constraints essentially, and then there are. This is essentially just figuring out what are the unassigned variables. All it is an unassigned variable is the one which has zero currently. Okay. And then the other thing, of course, is there are a bunch of small utilities. That's it. That's the whole code. Okay, so the code is quite manageable. It's like probably 2 pages long. And that's all you need to change. You know, of them, you would essentially wind up writing at the minimum, the least constrained variable, most constrained variable, least constraining value, and forward checking. That at least you will write. So you can at least start working on those. I will put up the write-up for the project already by the end of today. But you know that those you have to write. And I can also tell you that if you do it right, each of them are a couple of lines long. So it's really mostly understanding what the program is doing and, you know, understanding what forward checking is supposed to do, just writing that. Okay. You can use the existing pieces of code to do most constrained variable, least constraining value, as well as forward checking. Okay. Then, of course, as usual, the more interesting part we would want to do is test cases. You can take any possible Sudoku array. I mean, from any, you know, there are like a million Sudoku sites, and you can pick any of them and then see whether you can solve them or not. But this is a complete algorithm. The one I gave you is already complete. Okay, it would work. It's just slow. Okay. So, so these are test. Yes.
Sorry, I'd like to recommend. I'm not. I think it has stuff rather than Windows, but I know it works on Windows. This program is pretty called Simple Sudoku, and it's good for messing around with it and generating.
Yeah, yeah. There are like a whole bunch of sites, you know, to both Java applets as well as, you know, generating Sudoku puzzles and so on. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, here are a bunch of test cases. These are the minimum ones that you will try. You can try more, okay? And this is kind of easy, this is somewhat medium hard, this is hard without any heuristic, and to see this is hard without any heuristic, here are statistics for my completed code. You know, so if I try to solve this with just the code I gave you, it takes about 10 minutes on my laptop, okay? And it took 3 million assignments. So it basically, remember that if you are lucky, you only do as many assignments as there are number of zeros, right? Because those are the only ones that are requiring assignments. You shouldn't have to assign and unassign, okay? Anything you did above the number of zeros is extra backtracking that you're doing, okay? So it turns out that if I just do it using my simple idea, the code that I gave you, it takes 3 million. If I do, you know, least constraining value and most constrained variable, I will do it in 264,000. And if I throw in forward checking, I can do it in 222. So So there you go. I mean, it's like small pieces of code which make a huge amount of difference.
In terms of runtime, does the forward checking, like I know it does less assignments.
Yeah, it's a very good point. It actually is much faster too.
It is?
Yes. But you will check that too. Okay. It's a very good point. In fact, we will talk about it a little bit today. You can do a lot more inference. In most Sudoku games, essentially there is a unique solution that can be found just by inference. You never have to do search. Okay. Now, the point, of course, is you will see that it's you know, amount of inference you do and the amount of search you do are sort of like, again, that beautiful picture we drew for ourselves. As you do more and more inference, the time for inference is going up. Okay, so for example, you know, like no inference is like here, maybe forward checking is right here. The thing that I told you about arc consistency, it's somewhere here. Okay, you can, for example, do unit propagation, which is also a kind of inference, and we'll talk about it today, and maybe it's somewhere right here. Okay, and then if you do full resolution, you are somewhere there. Okay, and then of course, as you do this amount of inference, the amount of search you have to do will reduce. In the beginning, it's very high. As you do more and more inference, the search reduces. Okay, so it's exactly like the heuristic idea, except here the inference winds up playing that role. Amount of inference winds up playing that role. So the question is, which is the best part? It depends on the summation. Okay. In fact, there is this idea called K-consistency. I probably will explain it to you at some point of time. And K-consistency gives you a nice way of talking about inference, amount of inference you are doing. One consistency, two consistency. Two consistency is like R consistency. And then three consistency and so on up to n consistency. N is the number of variables. Okay. It turns out that to enforce k consistency on a CSP, you would do n power k amount of work. Okay. So if you are talking about k consistency as k is increasing, this is n power k. It's increasing too. But as you have full consistency, if you have full consistency, you don't have to do any search at all. You can just go directly to the solution. So full consistency for CSPs is the perfect heuristic. But then when you do full consistency, you have solved much more than just your little problem. Okay. So normally the interesting question is, if you're thinking in terms of this K consistency, what's the level of consistency that you should enforce such that the total time you spend doing the consistency enforcement and the time you spend doing search total is minimized. And in most problems, the break-even point occurs at two consistency, which is why arc consistency and forward checking are interesting. In some cases of problems, the break-even point appears at three consistency. But in general, I can always make a problem where you have to go arbitrarily high consistency to get the minimum. But in most problems, two consistency seems to work well. Okay. Anyway, so that's the point. So forward consistency is cheaper than two consistency. It turns out the forward checking is cheaper than enforcing two consistency. It turns out. Okay. And so in fact, although your point is very well taken that assignments is not telling the full story. If you take the actual runtime, the runtime here is a fraction of the runtime here. Okay. So that's basically the CSP project, and there are some more tests and so on. And then, as usual, you'll spend more time analyzing. You'll write a piece of code, and then you'll spend more time analyzing how are the various ideas helping or hindering. And also, if you keep adding two or three ideas, are they summative? So, for example, if I add forward checking and dynamic variable and variable ordering heuristic together, is it better than just any one of them? That sort of a thing. It turns out some ideas wind up conflicting with each other, that their total efficiency is not equal to the sum of the two efficiencies because they're more or less doing the same thing. So that's the kind of analysis you'll wind up doing. Okay? Question? Yes?
Is it possible that adding a, or removing a constraint like the diagonal constraint could push the problem in or out of that, that spike region with the ratio of the variables?
That's a very good question. In fact, I am not completely clear on the theory of the critical constraint region for Sudoku. I have to read it up myself. Okay. Sudoku, as CSP problems go, is a weird CSP problem. You know, in the sense that the way the size of this problem never increases. It's about the same. It's basically 9x9 array. But you can, within that, you can make it critically constrained versus easy versus hard, you know, easy versus over-constrained, okay? But, you know, the only reason we are looking at this is it's something that you know. So I could make, we could make code for any generic CSP problem. But then if you have some connection to some reality you know, you might be more interested in doing it. That's the only reason we're looking at it.
You can even make
yes, you can, but, you know, but in fact, a version of this project would do, you know, I guess, the 3x3, 6x6, 9x9, etc. Sudokus. You know, you can generalize it. 9x9 is the one that we all play with, mostly because, you know, below that it's too easy, above that it's too hard for us. Okay, it's the same reason for the tile puzzles. You know, people try like 15 puzzle once in a while. 8 puzzle is what most kids play with, and 15 puzzle maybe you might consider trying, but 24 puzzle is not worth it. Okay. Yes. Yes, I'm going to, since I set the whole thing up, I'm going to have to talk about it. I will do it. Let me see if I can find it. So these are sites that were there but I didn't discuss last time. Okay, it's worth talking about it. You know, even though we're going back a little bit, it's worth talking about it. So remember when we were talking about, so this is actual, it's not just for this project, it's the great idea that you want to understand, you know, and since I'm talking about it now, it's legal for me to ask questions on this, okay? So pay attention. So the basic idea that we looked at last time was where are the hard problems in CSP, and we looked at this critical transition region. Okay, so one way of looking for hard problems was basically looking at the number of constraints and the number of variables, taking in some sense the ratio of the number of constraints to the number of variables and see how it goes. If it is small, that means it's easy to solve. It's large, it is also easy to solve, but it's just not solvable. Okay, but in between is where it becomes hard. That's one way of understanding. But another characterization of understanding what happens when CSPs become hard is the following. Think about what, from the search point of view, think about the systematic search point of view. What is it that makes a CSP hard? CSP becomes hard because, you know, you start with some variable, let's say X, give it a value, then you pick next variable Y, you give it a value, then you pick the third variable. If you can give it a value and give it a value to for all the variables in one line, you're done. The only reason CSP is hard is the values you gave to X and Y wind up interacting with the value you gave to Z, in which case you have to backtrack. Okay? So the idea is what seems like a good locally good decision, which is this variable can have this value, winds up being globally not correct. Okay, so if you are really unlucky, what could happen is that you would wind up, if there are x1 to x100 variables, you will give x1 equal to v1, and then you will give x2 equal to v2, blah, 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 and then x100, you will try to give a value, and you will turn out that because of the constraints, x100 has no more values left. And in fact, the problem was x1 and x2. The constraints were such that if x1 is v1 and x2 is v2, then x100 has no values left. In the beginning, you didn't know. You know, you were just saying, this is fine, I can continue, and here I came and I had to backtrack. So The reason CSPs are hard is because, in the simplest way of thinking about it, that the CSP is hard because a legal assignment over k minus 1 variables may not be extendable to kth variable. That's one way of thinking about why CSPs are hard. So you just gave values to k minus 1 variables. It may not be extendable to kth variable. Now here is the interesting thing. So in this particular case, in this particular problem, this k was 3. The reason this problem was failing was a legal assignment for 2 variables could not be extended to a third variable. Now notice that the third variable actually didn't come right after them. It came much later. Because at the time you gave values to x1 and x2, you don't know what is going to be the third variable. So if you want to make this property hold for any k, let's say I want to make this property, I mean this problem go away for, you know, let's say k equal to 3, then what I should do is for every legal assignment of any two variables, I should make sure that any third variable will also have a legal value. Do you understand what I'm saying now? For any two variables which have a legal partial assignment, that, you know, I should be able to ensure that if you gave me any third variable, I will be able to give you a value for the third variable. If I do that, then I would say I have somehow converted my CSP to be a three consistent CSP. That means this CSP now is going to, in this CSP now, every two assignment can always be extended to any third variable. Okay? Now, so the K consistency is an N variable CSP problem is said to be K consistent if every consistent assignment for K minus 1 of the N variables can be extended to include any kth variable. This is a huge for all. Okay, for every possible pair of variables from the N variables and any legal assignment for them, any legal assignment for them, and for any third variable that I get to pick from the N minus 2 variables that are remaining, I will still be able to give a value to that third variable. Okay, that is K consistency. Now the interesting thing about K consistency is you can increase K from 0 to 1 to 3 to 1 to 2 to 3 to etc. up to N. If your problem is N consistent, then what it means, if your problem is, what I want to say is the following. If your problem is 1, 2, 3, etc. up to k consistent, then I would call it strongly k consistent. Remember that sometimes it's actually possible for problems to be 3 consistent but not 2 consistent. It's a weird scenario. Okay, I'll give you examples of all this on the homework so you get to do it. Okay. So it is actually possible for some problem to be 3 consistent but not 2 consistent. So to handle that, we consider the notion of strong K consistency. A strong K consistency is valid if in fact it's 1 consistent, 2 consistent, all the way up to K consistent. Now if I say a problem is strongly N consistent and the problem has N variables, then I believe I just proved that problem is extremely easy to solve. Because since it is strongly N consistent, okay, if I can pick any variable, so if it has a solution, okay, assume that it is actually satisfiable. That means it does have a solution and is strongly N consistent. So then I can pick any variable and I will be able to give it a value. Then I can pick any second variable, I would be able to give that a value too because it's too consistent. And I now can pick any third variable and extend these two variables assignment to the third variable without backtracking because it's pre-consistent. And so on all the way to n variables. So if I have enforced n consistency on a CSP problem, it's solved. Of course, what's the catch? The catch is enforcing k consistency is O n k. Enforcing k consistency is oftentimes n power k amount of work. Okay? So this is exactly the beautiful curve we were talking about. You know, if I have k equal to, this is the k consistency, k equal to 1, 2, etc. n. As I increase the consistency, I will keep increasing the amount of work I am doing. Okay? And then as I increase the consistency, I will reduce the amount of search I do. So somewhere along this is the total winds up being minimum. The question is, where does it become minimum? You cannot be sure. In general, for any random problem, it can happen at any possible k consistency. However, it turns out that the break-even for most problems seems to be occurring with k equal to 2, which is arc consistency, which is also called arc consistency, because when k equal to 2, in essence, what you're doing is, if you remember, the reason it's called arc consistency is if you have binary CSPs, right? If you have binary CSPs, the constraint graph is basically an actual graph between variables, right? An actual graph between variables. Variables are the vertices, constraints are the edges. An arc consistency says that for any variable in this graph, if I give a value to it, I will be able to extend that assignment to any other variable. Now notice that the variables that are not directly connected to it, you don't have to worry because they're independent. You can always extend it. The ones that are connected to it, there is a constraint and I need to make sure that I can extend it. Okay? So now suppose I have the following kind of a situation. This is x, this is y, and this, and then it turns out that x and y are both between 1 to 10. Those are the values that they can take, 1 to 10. Okay? So originally, x is between 1 to 10, and y is between 1 to 10. I'll now want to explain to you what would it mean to enforce arc consistency. What you wind up doing is, for every value of x, there must be a value of y. That's what arc consistency means. As given, is that true? Because this constraint, okay, I didn't give you the constraint. Constraint is x less than y. That's the constraint. As given, what happens if x equal to 1? Is there a value for 1? Value for y? No. So to make this arc consistent, I have to add to this problem an extra constraint saying y not equal to 1. Adding a constraint y not equal to 1 happens to be, in this case, adding a constraint y not equal to 1 is the same as just removing 1 from the y's domain. But I do want you to think of what you did as adding a constraint y not equal to 1, because enforcing k consistency involves adding k minus 1 array constraint. Yes, wait, we'll get to that. Okay? That's a very good question, by the way. So if I actually am doing forward checking, what I would do is I would have already decided what my variables are. In doing forward checking in a search tree, right, let's say this is x, and up to here, I started from root node, this is x. Okay, and actually let me make something else. I started from the root node, I did x1, and then followed by x7, and now I'm stuck here. And I'm about to decide what to do. I just gave a value x1 equal to 5, x7 equal to 9. Okay. Now there are still variables. Suppose the total number of variables is x1 to x100. Based on where you are, I can say that this is the current variable, x7 is the current variable. X1 and above, the variables above in the search tree are past variables because they have already been given values. And the outside, the ones below are future variables. You do forward checking only with respect to current variables, current value, and the future variables. That's all you do. So forward checking is a sub case of arc consistency. There you wind up saying if x7 equal to 9, you would not go back and see what are the values that are still feasible for x1, because x1 is already done. You just consider all the future variables that you have still not assigned and see what are the feasible values left in forward checking. See, forward checking is done as part of the search. Arc consistency, like heuristics, is done before the search starts. It's pre-processing step. So what you're trying to do in doing arc consistency is you're given a CSP called CSP1. You convert it into a CSP called CSP2, which has the same variables, but potentially more constraints. Now these constraints, like y not equal to 1, is this a constraint that is surprising? No. It was a constraint that is actually deducible. You can prove that this must hold if you know that all these constraints are holding. So this was an entailment. If you have this CSP, this constraint is entailed. So what you did was you take the CSP1, do a whole bunch of theorem proving, and basically unearthed constraints that are implicit. You made them explicit. Once you make them explicit, you get a CSP2. Now, the CSP1 and CSP2 are identical in the sense every solution of this is a solution of this and vice versa. Because the only thing that matters is solutions, not partial solutions. Okay? Every solution of this is a solution of this and vice versa. So if you want to solve this, you can solve this. So I did spend some time doing this entailment, got CSP2. And then I worked, and then I just do the search. Now, having said this, just a second. Having said this, suppose I started with CSP1. This entailment, of course, can be any amount of entailment. You can do full resolution, for example. But I'm just saying I'm only going to do arc consistency, which is like a part of the entailment. You'd only wind up doing n square amount of work. Okay. Now, suppose I already did arc consistency. Is there any point in doing forward checking during search?
I think so, because you could have chosen a different value than you could have chosen x equals 9.
No, problem is, if you do arc consistency, then essentially, so in this case, we are not yet arc consistent. For this particular problem, x is 1 to 10, y is 1 to 10 originally, you thought. But then you realize that for a value x equal to 1, there is no possible value for y. Okay? So you removed, I made a complete mistake here. If the constraint is x less than y, then x cannot be 1. Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. Exactly. You're right. I'm sorry. I was right then. Okay. So if x less than y, if x equal to 1, there is no value for, if x equal to 1, there is a value for y. If x equal to 10, there is no value for y. Okay? So x cannot be 10. And similarly, if y equal to 1, there is no value for x. Constraints are non-directional. If y equal to 1, there is no value for x. So y not equal to 1. Okay? And normally what this means is, suppose now I also have a z. Z was also originally supposed to be 1 to 10. And x should also be less than z. Then I should make sure that given these values that are now remaining for x, can the arc consistency hold on this? Now keep doing this until I cannot remove any values. That's when R consistency stops. Okay? So R consistency, when R consistency stops, you can take any variable, pick any value that is still remaining in its domain, and they can pick any other variable, and you would be able to pick a value for it from its domain. You would never have to worry. That's what R consistency is. Now it does a lot more work than forward checking. Forward checking only cares about, for the assignment you have done, is it consistent with, I mean, for the assignment you have done, make sure that there are no variables in the future variables, there are no values in the domains of the future variables that are inconsistent with the assignment you have already done.
So the technique is to just look at one variable, try all the values, and eliminate.
So our consistency technique is, yeah, you keep doing this until fixed point, until no more variables have their domains changing. Exactly. There are efficient ways of doing it, but clearly the more important thing I want you to understand is, A, R consistency is done before the problem starts, not after normally, because it's a pre-processing step, just like heuristic is computed before the problem starts, not after. Okay? But forward checking, etc., is being done sort of dynamically during the search based on your assignments. Yes. So your question is how to enforce our consistency now. Is that what you're saying? I want you to understand two different things. One is our consistency is more general than forward checking. Because once I give you a CSP and I say it is our consistent, you can disprove me by just giving one counter example. One variable and a value for it, and say, given this variable has this value, you cannot have a value for this other variable. That's all you need to show. Okay, so since you can prove me wrong by a counterexample, I have to do a for all, for every possible variable and every possible second variable, there's a way of extending the first variable's assignment to the second variable. Whereas in the forward checking, you only care about, given the current assignments of these variables, are they consistent with the remaining values of the remaining variables? So forward checking does part of the work that R consistency does, but it only does it on demand. And in fact, between R consistency and forward checking, there is another idea called directional consistency. What is directional consistency? It first asks you to give an ordering on the variables. If it is x1 to x100, then give me a natural ordering, so a permutation on x1 to x100. So assume, let's say, the ordering I gave you is x1 first, then x2, then x3, etc., x100. Directional consistency is basically going to check only, so once I pick a variable and a value for it, I only ensure that every variable that comes downstream in the ordering is going to have a value. Okay, whereas R consistency normally doesn't care about direction, because you don't know which direction you're going to actually work on the variable. Okay, so obviously if I happen to know that my search is only going to go from x1 to x100 in that order, doing R consistency is an overkill, because I will never ask, I have just given a value for x50, is there a value that I can still give for x47? Because by the time I came to x50, I must have gone through x47. Whereas if my search can do any possible variable ordering, then you would actually benefit from R consistency. Is this sufficiently confusing?
Could you take a one step further and do when k equals 3 and just show?
Yes. What happens in k equal to 3 is path consistency in the binary CSPs. So the definitions of k consistency that I gave you here, they don't care about whether the underlying constraint graph is a normal graph or a hypergraph. You can actually, this doesn't care about whether the constraints are all binary or not. But I did mention that the CSP community in general was particularly enamored with binary CSPs. So there is like a parallel theory, which is application of this just to binary CSPs, where two consistency is called arc consistency. So two consistency for binary CSPs is called arc consistency. And tree consistency for binary CSPs is called path consistency. Okay? And a path consistency essentially says that for any two variables which have been given values and any third variable, you will be able to give it a legal value which is consistent with the values that have been given to x and y. What's interesting is it's easy to see that a CSP can be two consistent but not three consistent. I mean, it is arc consistent but not, it's arc consistent but not path consistent. What is surprising is that it's actually opposite also is possible. You can also have a scenario where a CSP is path consistent but not arc consistent, which is why we have to think about strong consistency to talk about that thing. But the bigger, deeper point is, in general, if the consistency level increases, k higher levels of k, okay, you would wind up doing more work. To get k consistency, you have to do n power k amount of work. This is the kind of work would be, you know, for each possible value of x, you have to make sure that every connected variable has a value still left. If not, you remove that value from access domain. And you keep repeating it until you no longer can remove anybody's values. Then the CSP becomes arc consistent. And you have to do this for path consistency. That means you have to consider all pairs. Yes?
Okay, so then the CSP that is arc consistent, all the variables will have domains that are reduced from the similar CSP that's not arc consistent, right? Initial domain?
So, the only difference between a CSP which is arc consistent and a CSP that's not arc consistent is the domains will shrink.
Okay, so it's not just adding constraints, it's also.
No, but I want to know. So, you really are adding constraint. You are adding, to get k consistency, you add k minus 1 RE constraint. Okay? If you, to do arc consistency, which is 2 consistency, you add 1 RE constraint. What is a 1 RE constraint? It says some variable cannot have some value. That is why you wind up so arc consistency reduces the domain because it adds 1 RE constraint. But when you go to 3 consistency, you cannot see what is changing. The domains will remain. What changes is you are essentially adding extra 2 RE constraints. Okay, what happens in path consistency is, if there is a constraint from this to this and a constraint from this to this, to ensure path consistency, you will wind up adding a constraint from that to that, which is sort of stronger. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But in an arc consistent puzzle, any node
would
only have the value
it
can take on before you start actually solving the puzzle.
In an arc consistent puzzle, any node will only have values it can take on such that it can be expanded to include any arbitrary second variable. Do you understand what I'm saying? So suppose I have a CSP which says x1, x2, etc. up to x100 can be, I mean, x1 to x10 can have values 1 to 10. And then I right away tell you x1 never can be 7. Now, obviously, 7 has to be removed from the domain. That's different from saying x1 can be 1 to 10, x2 can be 1 to 10, but x1 must be less than x2. And in enforcing x1 less than x2, you wind up realizing as an indirect effect that x1 cannot be ever 10, and x2 cannot ever be 1. Okay? So arc consistency is not about a single variable, it's about pairs of variables. And tree consistency or path consistency is about triples of variables. Four consistency is about, you know, four variables at a time. It's a beautiful theory because it sort of makes the connection between heuristics which do pre-processing and then you do a star search versus k consistency which does pre-processing on a CSP to get a new CSP, which is hopefully easier to solve. The only problem is if you spend too much time getting the pre-processing done, you don't gain anything in the overall search. So the question, the big question is, where is the best place where k-consistency seems to work? And it's one of those things that in most problems, k equal to 2, which is arc consistency, seems to be the best place to start. Okay, although I can make problems where, for example, path consistency is important, it's normally not the case that you can come up with large classes of problems where high level consistency enforcement will pay its way. Yeah, but K levels, but look ahead somehow thinks in terms of current versus future. Its K consistency is K neighbors. Think of K neighbors. K levels of neighbors. Not just look ahead in any direction. You know, consistency is non-directional. Now, since consistency basically considers future, past, every possible variable, you can then consider many, many specializations of arc consistency, like directional arc consistency, forward checking, you know, which are basically special cases of arc consistency. Okay?
What is one?
Who is the guy who asked me what is K consistency? So he is responsible for whatever we did till now. Yes.
So far we are considering arc consistency
and property of the algorithm. We are checking for arc consistency. No, arc consistency, you enforce arc consistency on a CSP before you start.
So it's the property of the problem.
No, it's what you do to the problem before. See, the thing is, to solve a problem, you can start, as soon as the problem is given, you can try to solve it. Or you can first reduce the problem to a simpler problem and solve it. Now, the time you take to reduce the first problem to a simpler problem is added to your total time. Consistency enforcement basically takes a problem, enforces some level of consistency on it to get a simpler problem, which is definitely easier to solve than the first one. But the amount of time you spend from here to come here may not be paid for. Which is the beauty, because you know how much do I do before and how much do I do during runtime. Okay? Any other questions? Yes?
What is k equal to 1?
What is k equal to 1? No. What is k equal to 1? What is 1 consistency? That means there are no values in any variable's domain that are inconsistent with a unary constraint on that variable. The example that I gave you earlier, if I said x1 and x2 can both be 1 to 10, and I said x1 can never be 7, by the way, then the problem is not even 1 consistent. Right? I take a value that is in the domain and I say, whoop, that's not possible. I'm not even considering any other variable. That's 1 consistency. So 1 consistency is going to be trivially easy to enforce if you just make sure that you remove all the values that are inconsistent with the unary constraints from the domain. But think about it this way, I mean, in a way this is sort of deeper than, you know, some of the things that we have done in the class, but it's a beautiful theory, because if you think of K consistency as adding K minus 1 array constraints, and if you think of a constraint essentially as a, if I give you a constraint like, if I have a k minus 1 array, here is a 2 array constraint. If x equal to 1 and y equal to 2 implies z not equal to 3. That's a this is a 3 array constraint, and I might add this kinds of constraints if I'm trying to enforce 4 consistency. Now, this can be seen as a propositional formula. If this were true, it was because the original CSP entails this. How do you do entailment? Using resolution. Okay? So inference is resolution. The most general case of inference is resolution. Or, you know, of course, modus ponens is a cheaper resolution. Okay? 2 consistency is cheaper than K consistency. But you know, if you want to do all possible, if I give you a CSP, if I give you a knowledge base and I say write down all other formulas that follow from whatever you know, then you are essentially running resolution theorem proving until you cannot, you know, you cannot get any more new clauses. That's essentially what full consistency enforcement does. Okay, so consistency is enforcement is inference. And search is finding the model. And you can help finding the model by doing inference. Now, and since I have said that, let me actually translate into today's class and show you So first of all, you have to understand that if you are doing forward checking in CSP, you are actually doing inference. Because in essence, if it were to be the case that at some point of place you had x equal to 2, you set x equal to 2 in this branch, and you went ahead and said, oh, by the way, x 100 now can no longer be 15. And so you remove 15 from it. That's what you do in forward checking, right? Now, how did that happen? It's because you have x equal to 2, and there is some constraint which says x equal to 2 implies x 100 not equal to 15. And you did theorem proving on this, and this is what the entailed. So when you did forward checking, you were doing inference. Okay? I'll show you another example of doing inference in SAT solving, which is also a CSP, except it is a funnier CSP. It is Boolean variables. All variables are Boolean. Right? So one of the interesting questions is, in the case of Boolean variables, how would you go about, you know, the idea of least constrained variable doesn't make too much sense, because each variable has only two values. So a variable can either have all two values left, or just one value, in which case you have to take that value, or zero values, in which case you have to backtrack. Okay, so what you wind up doing is essentially, having given an assignment for a bunch of variables, you try to do some inference. And the kind of inference you can do is you can actually do resolution theorem proving, for example. But resolution theorem proving is too costly. So you do unit propagation, where unit propagation is nothing but resolution, where one of the clauses is of length 1. I mentioned these two classes back. If one of the clauses is of length 1 and you only do those resolutions, then you can do it in polynomial time. Okay? And what happens if you do the resolution, unit resolution, is you will still do some amount of inference, not as much as full resolution. And then as part of this, you might either show that there is an inconsistency, in which case you backtrack, or you will show that some of the future variables now have forced values, in which case you may as well just take those values for those variables. Okay? A very celebrated procedure for solving SAT problems, it's one of the first procedures, and it's one of the first papers in the Journal of ACM, you know, celebrated papers in computer science, called the Davis-Putnam-Lajman-Loveland procedure, essentially does CSP for SAT. And it does two things, okay? So if you go through this, and I'll show you an example in a minute, if you go through this, this pure symbol is a special thing. I'll explain that to you. But the more important thing is find unit clause, which is doing unit propagation, to see if there's an inconsistency or if there's a forced value. If it's an inconsistency, you backtrack. If it's a forced value, you take that value. Okay? Let me show you an example of this, of Davis-Putnam procedure in action, okay? Where you wind up doing search, which is pick a variable and consider a value for it, and then do unit propagation on top of it. Okay? So these are the clauses I have. These are the clauses I have. And let's say I pick P. Now notice that if these are the clauses, the variables are P, S, U, Q, R, T. Those are the variables. So I have to, in general, I have to pick each of those variables and give them true false values until everybody is taken. So let's pick P, and you know, you consider setting P to true. And then on the other branch you set P to false. So suppose I set P to true. Then now I want to do unit propagation. What do I do? So I have to, unit propagation involves essentially resolving a unit clause with a non-unit clause. Unit clause means a clause of length 1. Now when I set P equal to true, that is a clause, by the way, because it's now P is actually added to my database temporarily. So I can resolve, so first of all, when I do unit propagation, one of the things I do is, since P is true, PSU is already holding. This constraint is holding. Would you guys agree? Because this is PRSRU. So actually, as far as I'm concerned, it's not even part of the problem for this particular branch.
Wait, real quick, the column means or?
Yes, because remember the idea is the CNF clauses are of the form not P, R, Q, R, S. And so normally you write it as not P, Q, S. That's a CNF clause, okay? So that no longer even is a constraint because it's already satisfied. Now, take this constraint, not P or Q. P is true. So you do just a resolution, I get Q. If I got Q, that means Q is true. So I'll go ahead and say Q is true too. Even though I just thought in this branch, I just said P equal to true, now in a sense, I also set Q equal to true. There's no way I can set P equal to true without setting Q equal to true, because it's entailed. Okay? Now, I have set Q equal to true. Now, since, so now at this point, this is gone. Not P or Q is now satisfied, so you remove it. Now, Q and Q or not S or T is now satisfied because Q is true in this branch. So you remove that. Now Q can be resolved with not Q or R. Notice the cascading of inferences. This is something that doesn't happen in forward checking. Normally forward checking only considers one level of inference. Okay. Here you are cascaded of inferences. So you set P equal to true. That allowed you to derive Q. Then you used Q to derive R. Okay, so now R is true too. Okay, at this point not Q or R is satisfied. So that's kind of removed now. Okay, so in fact I should have been putting lines through it so that you know what constraints are left. Now, and also of course since R is true, RS is satisfied. That's also satisfied, so you can remove that. That as far as this branch is concerned, that is satisfied too. Now at this point, so up to here, it's already very interesting. You thought you just said P equal to true, but indirectly you said Q equal to true and R equal to true. So you did a big jump without actually searching, just by inference. Okay. Now at this point, what you will see that in the remaining clauses, in all the remaining clauses, S occurs in the negative form. So in all the remaining clauses, so if I remove, so this not P or Q is removed, this is removed, this is removed, and this is also removed. So only these two clauses were left. And in both those clauses, S is occurring in the same form, negative S. Since I have to make them true, just make negative S to be true. Okay? It turns out that if you do that, it's a heuristic that will not lead to loss of completeness. If the original theory had a model, then if you do pure literal elimination, you will still have a model. Now, it turns out, if in fact the models have differing costs, then it's not a good heuristic to use. Okay, so this is one place where if all models are not equally created, you won't do pure literal elimination. But, you know, DPLL does that because it assumes any model is as good as any other model. Okay, so you do this. At this point, I said not S equal to true, which means S equal to false. So in essence, I've said P true, Q true, R true, and S false, at which point all the variables, all the constraints are satisfied. Now I did not yet give a value to T. Do I care? No, there's no constraints left. So I can pick any value for T and it will be a model.
What if, for example, that bottom constraint said not S, comma, not T? Or
yes, in which case you wouldn't have done this. So this is an extreme case. It is an extreme case which sort of proves the point that by doing simple unit propagation and literal elimination, you pretty much got done with the problem. Normally what happens is you do some search, so you pick P equal to true, do unit propagation and pure literal elimination, that will still leave some constraints. You pick one of the variables that are still unassigned and that are present in those constraints and branch on them again.
I guess my point was if pure elimination actually chose a value that ultimately killed your...
It's not possible. You pure literal elimination can only be done if all the remaining constraints have a literal appearing in the same form, either it's purely positive or purely negative. If you do that, then you can prove to yourself that you could never have, if there was a solution originally, you will still have a solution. But as I said, if the solutions have differing costs, it turns out that having S equal to true is costlier than S equal to false, let's say, then this won't work because you won't find the lowest cost model necessarily. But this is basically DPLL, and the point I want you to think of is in the DPLL, forward checking is playing, I'm sorry, in the DPLL, unit propagation is playing the same role as forward checking is playing in the normal CSP algorithm. And the only thing common between them is that both of them are entailments. Both of them are inferences. Why do you do only yield propagation? Because if you do too much resolution, you would wind up spending more time in the inference, and that's not normally paid for in the search. Okay? Now, let me show you. Okay. Okay, this is basically the pure literal elimination definition. We already saw stochastic hill climbing procedure for solving SAT problems. The problem with that was it could not be used to show that a particular set of clauses have no model. If there is a model, a local search might find it. If there is no model, local search can never show that there is no model. Okay? That's why you like DPLL, which is systematic. Because if the original SAT clauses don't have a solution, it will end by saying there is no solution. If they do have a solution, it will end by showing you a solution. So you can actually use this to do propositional theorem proving. Remember, if you want to prove a theorem, right, you take the negation of whatever you want to prove, add it to the knowledge base, do DPLL and see if it says no solution, in which case what you added, negation of it was actually entailed. So that sort of completes the cycle regarding local search versus systematic search. And also leads me to talk a little about, since we did this complete detour, but let's make a good hay out of it, that there are lots and lots of SAT solvers, and much of the way they differ essentially is, as I said in the beginning, for a while when the SAT solving competition started, local search solvers used to win the competition. But they cannot ever show that a SAT instance is unsolvable. And we're talking about, you know, essentially, now I think billions of variables, right? You should know. How many, what is the number, what's the size of SAT solvers now? What is the, we are actually able to solve millions of variables, SAT clauses, okay, right now. It's a continuing competition. Every year there is a SAT competition. Now, part of the reason SAT is interesting is that people like him who are from EE are very interested in doing SAT solutions because they are also very useful for model checking and circuit verification, etc. Okay, and so there are people from various different disciplines who have found this one problem that they all love, and so they're all trying to solve it, and so every year there's a beautiful, more and more interesting solutions. So in the beginning, DPLL of course was the first. Around 94 came a local search algorithm called GSAT. In 96, and then at that point, for a while, people thought only local search will ever win. Systematic search will never win. Okay? And now what's interesting is in 1997, there was a solver called SAT-Z. It's actually very easy to understand what SAT-Z does. With respect to the DPLL procedure that I just showed you, the one thing that DPLL is doing randomly is pick a variable and give it a value. Once it gives a value, it spends a lot of time doing inference. Why not pick a variable with some thought? CSP was doing it. CSP was picking a variable that has the most constrained variable, for example. Now, the problem with using that heuristic in SAT is a variable either has two values or one value or zero value. If it is one or zero, it's already done. If it is two, everybody is two. Right? So most constrained variable heuristic is not useful in SAT. So how would you pick a variable to branch on? The interesting idea that somebody came up with is, notice that you picked a variable, set it as a value, and then did a whole bunch of unit propagation, right? What if for each variable you simulated how much unit propagation you could have done, okay, for each variable, and pick the variable which winds up reducing the theory when the unit propagation happens and most of the constraints get satisfied. Right, the variable that winds up allowing most amount of unit propagation is the one I will pick, and then I will do that unit propagation for that. People would not even consider this idea. They would actually laugh people out of the room saying, are you crazy? I mean, so much work just to pick a variable. And when SAT-Z came along, everybody and their brother assumed that it will fail miserably, and it won the competition that year. It essentially considers a large number of variables, sees which of them are likely to lead to most amount of unit propagation, so it does more work first, then picks the variable that in fact is doing the most amount of unit propagation and does it. Okay? Beautiful idea, you know, in terms of how much work before versus how much work later. And of course, after SATG came RELSAT, which added on top of essentially the SATG idea, the idea of dependency-directed backtracking, which I told you earlier. Based on the backtrack failure, if in fact the failure was that you could not give X100 a value, and the reason you can't give it is because X1 has an offending value, there's no point going through X99, X98, X97, all the way to X1, right? You should go all the way to X1 and redo. RELSAT essentially did that dependency-directed backtracking. And it won the competition around 98-99. Okay? And then in 2000, I and my wife actually keep our marriage intact by not ever caring about each other's work. She does VLSI design. I never look at her work. And the only course I actually dropped in my entire career as a student was VLSI design. I kid you not. And then the only course she was laughing her head off was the AI course. During a graduate study. So we have a good marriage because we don't talk about work to each other. And in 2000, suddenly, I noticed that she was having this DAC proceedings, which is a Design Automation Conference proceedings, and there was Chap Salver, which was the winner of that competition that year. This was a bunch of electrical engineering guys who were also interested in the problem. They essentially engineered the solver using some of the same ideas plus more, and Chap won the competition. And 2000, now actually, there's a winner is Siege. CHAF, Siege, RELSAT, SATG, all of these are systematic solvers. And you know, they have, of course we are interested in this for CSP and entailment issues, and the double dweebs are interested in it because they want to, you know, verify large scale circuits. Okay? And then the kind of theories we heard of, which is amount of inference versus amount of search, wind up being very important in understanding how these algorithms have been developed. Okay, if you are interested in actually finding the current status, go to satlive.org. I think there is a URL there which is in the wrong color. Satlive.org, which tells you the current SAT solver. And if you want like a text-oriented description of current SAT solvers, at least as of 2005, read that paper. Okay. So we'll stop here and we'll actually go back to propositional logic and probabilistic logic next class, which is what I was supposed to do. But this was like the class length detour that we did.